You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. All in the Family. James Reginato checks in on the fourth generation of Gettys, a lively batch of great-grandchildren from America's most infamous oil dynasty, in this sneak preview of Growing Up Getty. In the photos, Balthazar Getty and his wife Rosetta at their former home in the Hollywood Hills, 2017, and Ivy Getty in San Francisco, 2021. Stand back, it's about to get whack. Single dropping in a couple hours, whack, Balt Getty, whack. Behind a turntable, set up in the parking lot of a strip mall on Fairfax Avenue in Los Angeles, on an evening in June 2019, Paul Balthazar Getty, J. Paul Getty's eldest great-grandchild, was whipping up the crowd. At his invitation, a couple hundred local hipsters and characters, including Tommy the Clown, the hip-hop dancing L.A. legend, had gathered for a block party. At 44, Balthazar had much to celebrate. Monk Punk, his Lux streetwear line, was debuting. His retail store, housed in a former Radio Shack outlet, was opening. And his latest hip-hop track, entitled Whack, if you hadn't guessed, was about to drop. A father of four, Balthazar was now one of Hollywood's most multi-hyphenates. Actor, producer, director, DJ, musician, artist, fashion designer, shopkeeper. His trajectory into fashion began when he started customizing items of clothing with his own sketches, as well as with variations of the old Getty Oil logo. Then he took his designs to the next level, with a line of accessories and clothing, which he christened Monk Punk. "It came to me one night," he explained. "It makes you think of spirituality, being in touch with your emotional side, let's say. But then, you're still a punk, so I'm not a wimp. You're not going to push me around. It's about embodying both sides, both of which I think are important." Balthazar, wearing an oversized Monk Punk white T-shirt, a large gold chain, and a pink knit cap, showed off the line's lookbook, which featured former members of the Rollin 60s neighborhood Crips, the fearsome street gang. "Instead of models," I said, "let's do something authentic. No styling. You guys just rock it how you would rock it." As he has pointed out, this Getty wasn't born with a silver spoon. "I grew up scrappy. The money wasn't there." Balthazar's spigot to the Getty fortune had been temporarily turned off in utero. It was September 1974, when his father, J. Paul Getty III, married his mother, Gisela Schmidt-Zacher, in Tuscany. She was about 5 months pregnant, and he, at 18, was 4 years below the age at which he and his siblings were permitted to marry, according to the terms of the trust his parents set up when they divorced. Patriarch J. Paul Getty, JPG, did agree to give his grandson a small allowance. It was also decided that Rome, where he'd been abducted the year before, wasn't a safe home for the newlyweds. Weeks after the couple moved to Los Angeles, Balthazar was born. In Balthazar's toddler years, the electricity at the family's bungalow in Laurel Canyon was sometimes turned off due to unpaid bills. In a small apartment in San Francisco, where his mother took him after she and Paul separated, he slept on a futon. Then, one afternoon in 1988, after a casting agent spotted the 13-year-old at school, he landed a lead role in a film adaptation of Lord of the Flies. Returning to L.A. from the shoot in Jamaica, Balthazar had money in his pocket. He was unabashed about enjoying the bling. He dated Drew Barrymore and went clubbing all night with the Beastie Boys. Yet even with continued success in films, family sorrows took their toll. His father's misfortune wasn't just a private family matter. It was yet another manifestation of the Getty curse, as the press repeated time and again. That's a lot to cope with, and you're growing up, and I didn't handle it well, Baltazar said. He became, in the 1990s, a third-generation heroin addict. Without Mom's guidance, I'd be dead. In fact, I did die several times. I was just lucky. A recovered Baltazar later told the London Times. Member of a troubled dynasty, read the headline. Normally these things don't have a happy ending, but my family are together and made me want to be a better person. Just days after Baltazar set up his turntable in the strip mall parking lot, his second cousin, Isabel, could be found inside the royal enclosure at Royal Ascot, under the gaze of the Queen, the Prince of Wales, and the Duchess of Cornwall, who were seated above in the royal box. Isabel, a budding artist and musician, had been asked to paint one of the benches beside the track. She transformed it with cross-hatching, inspired by the forms and colors of the Viennese secessionist Egon Schiele and Gustav Klimt. Looking on proudly were her parents, Christopher, son of JPG's second son Ronald, and Pia, one of the three daughters of duty-free billionaire Robert Miller. Per the strict rules of Royal Ascot, the Gettys were in regulation attire, top hat and morning coat for him, dresses of modest length with straps of 1 inch or greater, and fanciful hats for the ladies. A mass of violet-hued feathers extended from Isabel's bonnet. Born in New York City, where she spent her early childhood in her parents' six-story townhouse, Isabel is a picture of transatlantic poise. At 8, she moved with her mother to London. She later boarded in Switzerland at La Rossi, where she was a member of the choir. She graduated from New York University's Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music. Yet she was still scared of performing. Of all people, it was Diana Ross who helped Isabel get over her stage fright. It was May 2013 at Farmington Lodge, an 18th-century manor house in England's Cotswolds, belonging to her aunt and uncle, Marie Chantal and Pavlos of Greece, where 400 guests had gathered to celebrate her maternal grandfather's 80th birthday. At one point, Ross, the gala's entertainer, pulled Isabel on stage. "It's Diana Ross passing you the mic. You better bloody sing," she remembers thinking to herself in panic. Isabel deftly belted out some classic Supremes lines. It was pretty epic, she recalls. After NYU, she moved back to London. Within a few months, she landed on the cover of Tatler, as well as on Dolce & Gabbana's runway in Milan. With two friends, she formed a band, Jean Marlowe. Isabel identified herself, the group's singer-songwriter, as Izzy Getty. Her voice is soft, slightly raspy. The band has a soulful grunge, soft rock sound. We're die-hard acoustic musicians, Isabel said. On Spotify and iTunes, Jean Marlowe has released several EPs, for which she drew the album art. In 2020, following a lockdown stay in Los Angeles, the group released Santana Winds, a hypnotic ballad inspired by Southern California's fierce and sometimes evil winds. There was so much destruction going on, Isabel recalled a year later from Gstaad, Switzerland. By this time, things were considerably brighter. She had just returned from Mykonos, where she and her South African-reared cousin Vanessa Weibel staged a high-spirited bachelorette weekend for their San Francisco relation Ivy Getty. Photos of the girls, at one point in matching pink hot pants, dancing stage-side at Jackie O, the fashionable beach club, splashed across Instagram and the Daily Mail. "They are like sisters. We grew up together," Isabel said of Vanessa and Ivy. "I'm very close to a lot of my cousins." Despite living across four continents today, most of JPG's approximately 40 great-grandchildren are surprisingly close-knit. Her extended family has had its troubles, she acknowledged. But everyone has tragedies in their families. It's just that ours have been more public. There has been a lot of suffering, but that's why it's important to stay grounded and together. Other young Gettys, some by way of marriage, have been cutting glamorous figures through Europe. Sabine, née Ghanim, was born in Geneva to a Lebanese father and Egyptian mother. But her introduction to the family happened one weekend in New York, where she was enrolled in the Gemological Institute of America. At a dinner party, she met Brown University undergraduate Joseph Getty, the British-raised son of Italian aristocrat Domitia Harding and Getty Images co-founder Mark Getty, a son of JPG's third-born Paul Jr. Joseph was smitten with Sabine. Long-limbed, brown-eyed, with a bob of flaxen hair, she was a commanding personality and a cosmopolitan air. Fashion mad, she describes her style as Bob Mackie meets Catherine Deneuve. After the couple settled in London, she launched her line of fine jewelry, Sabine G. Her fanciful pieces were soon adorning the likes of Celine Dion, Rihanna, Nicole Kidman, and Deneuve. On a brilliant morning in May 2015, a pack of paparazzi swarmed outside Basilica dei Santi, the 12th Apostoli in Rome, as a parade of young royals, including Princess Beatrice and Monaco's Pierre Casarighi, filed in. 33 years after Mark and Domitia were wed inside the ancient basilica, Joseph and Sabine chose to exchange their vows here. But where was the bride and her hooded cape? Since the latter stretched 23 feet and featured 500,000 sequins, hand-embroidered by Maison Lesage, shaped into an image of a radiating sun, it required its own minder and car, which threaded its way through Rome's tortuous traffic. At last, the garment arrived and was fastened to the bride, who was already clad in a figure-hugging, long-sleeved Duchesse silk dress, the handiwork of Schiaparelli haute couture. Tatler subsequently ranked Sabine and Joseph number 3 in its social power index, just behind the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. While many Gettys today lead surprisingly unglamorous lives, Sabine lives up to the expectations. She's the most Getty of them all, one social observer remarked. In the photos, Isabel Getty at the Royal Ascot in 2019. Sabine and Joseph Getty with their daughter at home in London, 2019. Anne Getty in her Pacific Heights living room, 1997. Gigi Gorgeous and Nats Getty's 2019 nuptials in Montecito. Balthazar Getty at work, 2019. J. Paul Getty III and Balthazar, 1975. In the non-glam category, there is Beau Perry, who labors in the remote reaches of Alaska. Americulturist, Beau is the largest grower of seaweed on the Pacific coast and at the forefront of sustainable marine aquaculture. Beau's mother, Claire Perry, is one of the three daughters born to JPG's first son, George. The Georgettes, as the women have been called, are all dedicated environmentalists and intensely private. Their offspring share their aversion to the press. Raised in Southern California and educated at Georgetown University, Beau founded his seaweed propagating company, Blue Evolution, in 2013. The next year, he headed north to Kodiak Island. He was among the first entrepreneurs who saw the potential to cultivate seaweed in Alaskan waters. "I have loved seaweed all my life," he once explained on Instagram. "As a surfer, I spent an eternity bobbing up and down amidst California's kelp forest. Traveling the coast, you can find giant kelp, bull kelp, sea palm, the list goes on. And they feel as different to me as beech, redwood, or oak forest." Blue Evolution provides Alaskan fishermen with seed stock, which it makes by extracting spores from wild kelp. The seedlings are grown on pieces of string known as seed pipes, which the fishermen thread along ropes that are suspended from a floating frame. After the planting is done in November, the ribbons of kelp grow up to a foot a day. weaving and protecting the lines is arduous. In May, Bo and his cohorts haul up the fruit of their labor, tons of nutritious, slimy green bunches. In the American branch of this dynasty, the epicenter is San Francisco, a palatial mansion in Pacific Heights, to be exact. Here, Ann and Gordon Getty, now 88, he is JPG's only surviving son, raised their four sons. At Christmas time, 1998, Billy, the youngest, became engaged to Vanessa Jarman. Anne, one of the era's most formidable grand dames, took a considerable interest in the bride's gown. She called her friend Oscar de la Renta in New York. "I want you to dress Vanessa," she told him, according to Boaz Mazur, a longtime de la Renta executive. "I want her to be the most beautiful bride ever. I want her to look unbelievable." Oscar dropped everything. He called in all his assistants. "The office was turned upside down," Mazur continued. "Then we got a call to cancel everything." Vanessa had decided to go with Narciso Rodriguez. For her, the new star designer agreed to make his first wedding dress since the one that had launched him to stardom, Carolyn Bessette's, for her wedding to John Kennedy Jr. in 1996. Anne was livid, furious, says Mazur. Yet when Vanessa made her entrance to the Renaissance-themed ceremony at a ranch in Napa Valley, riding side saddle on a speckled horse at sunset, pretty much everybody had to agree she chose right. Her form-fitting matte satin gown with crystal embroidered layers glistened. Gavin Newsom was the best man, and the 165 guests included a new assistant district attorney in town, a 34-year-old up-and-comer named Kamala Harris, Vanessa's new friend. The future governor's father, William Bill Newsom III, was Gordon's lifelong best friend. His grandfather, William Newsom II, was a beloved father figure to Gordon and his brother Paul Jr. during their boyhoods in the 1940s. 2 months after the wedding, Anne and Gordon were floating somewhere on the Mediterranean aboard a friend's 200-foot yacht when Gordon received a call, one he knew would come one day. At some point, the media was bound to expose the existence of his other family in Los Angeles. For some time, a small circle of San Franciscans, including Anne and their sons, had been aware of the situation, but it remained a secret. On August 20, 1999, the San Jose Mercury News broke the story. Billionaire Gordon Getty's secret family of four revealed. San Francisco socialite has three daughters, inheritance being negotiated. Anticipating this day, Gordon had prepared a statement. "Nicolette, Kendall, and Alexandra are my children. Their mother, Cynthia Beck, and I love them very much." Nicolette, then 14, Kendall, age 10, and Alexandra, who was 8, had been brought up with the surname Beck. In April 1999, a lawyer working on their behalf had filed documents requesting their names be changed to Getty. According to a Getty family friend, Gordon had revealed his secret first to his third-born son. Gordon drove over to see John in Berkeley. "You know, I have three daughters," he said. Understandably stunned, John kept the news to himself initially. Until one day, when Gordon, Anne, and the four boys were all aloft at 30,000 feet aboard their much-used two-bedroom gold-leafed 727, the Jetty. As a family discussion grew heated, John blurted it out. "Dad has another family." According to the source, Anne sat in her seat, stone-faced. "She was upset when she found out, but they came to an understanding," said another friend. By most accounts, Gordon, a well-respected composer of classical music, ended the affair with Cynthia. He introduced his Los Angeles family to his San Francisco family in hopes of establishing cordial relations, which by and large happened. 2 months after the news exploded, the San Francisco Chronicle's social scene column reported that Anne and Gordon Getty have been giving some simply marvelous dinner parties lately. Over the years, prominent San Franciscans saw Gordon's daughters at the gala holiday parties he and Anne hosted. Yet, as the girls matured, their creative and political endeavors remained relatively unknown, perhaps because none of the young women until recently chose to use the Getty name. On her Instagram account, at freudian.slit, Kendall identified herself as Kendall Abra, a name she used with various projects, too. In 2018, she founded the Angry Feminist Pinup Calendar to aid survivors of abuse and violence. Net proceeds were donated to organizations, including the Battered Women's Justice Project. In the calendar, she upends traditional pinup tropes to empower femme-identified people of all shapes, colors, sizes, and backgrounds, as she wrote. For her own turn as Miss March, she drew inspiration from some strong characters. We paid homage to one of my all-time favorite films, Barbarella, of course, from that fierce scene where Talitha Getty, uncredited, offers Barbarella a hit of Essence of Man. One of Kendall's tattoos on her right arm is a depiction of Barbarella. A nose ring and changing hair coloring, green sometimes, are among her other features. In 2020, after long being intrigued by talk of the so-called gay agenda, she published The Gay Agenda, a weekly planner meant to be, in her words, fabulous, as well as radical and fierce. Something to reinforce and reunite the LGBTQ plus with my kind of feminism, intersectional feminism, of course. Kendall is also a member of the Poetry Brothel, a roving, risque, literary burlesque where she has recited her poetry under the name Ophelia Up. According to its website, the Poetry Brothel strives to promote empowered sexuality practices and radically open artistic expression. On December 12, 2018, at freudian.slit/KendallAbra, posted a portrait she had painted in oil of Gordon, though she didn't identify him. "Today, my father lost his very best friend in the world," she wrote. "They'd known each other since they were about 12. I loved Bill, and I still do. Today hurts so badly, and I'm so tired of having feelings. Bill Newsom had passed away at age 84. 2 years later, the sudden death of John shook the family. Earlier in his life, he had struggled with drug addiction, but at 52, he was leading a full life and had become an attentive parent to his daughter Ivy, then 25. After his body was found in a neat hotel room in San Antonio, the coroner determined that he died accidentally due to cardiomyopathy and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, complicated by fentanyl toxicity. Just after his loss, Kendall again expressed her emotions on Instagram. 2 days ago, one of my brothers died. I find myself very affected by this loss. It's been scary being the bastard daughter of our father and his mistress in a family that's so notorious. I hid my truth, but never because I hated you guys. I'm sorry. I promise to take care of your daughter from here on out. Within days, she updated the name on her profile. She was now Kendall Getty. A year filled with considerable grief ensued for the entire family. Anne died of a heart attack in September 2020, but 2021 concluded with joyful events. On a vacation in Greece, Kendall's boyfriend, Johnny Latou, a musician, proposed to her at the Acropolis, and John's daughter, Ivy Love Getty, married her fiancé, Tobias Engel, a photographer in spectacular style. Capping 3 days of epic celebrations that began with a ball at the Palace of Fine Arts, where Earth, Wind, and Fire performed, the couple was joined in holy matrimony under the stately dome of San Francisco City Hall. When the ceremony began at 6 p.m. on Saturday, November 6th, Nancy Pelosi, the officiant, was resplendent in a gold Giorgio Armani pantsuit. Just before midnight the previous evening, the Speaker of the House, under the rotunda of the Capitol, had signed the hard-fought, historic $1.8 trillion bipartisan infrastructure framework. I hightailed it out of there for Ivy, who I've known since she was a baby, Pelosi told Guest. Ivy's spectacular gown, rumored to cost $500,000, featured four layers, the outermost one resembling fragments of a mirror, behind which trailed a 16-foot embroidered veil. It was the handiwork of one of her grandmother's favorite designers, John Galliano, who also dressed the bridal party, including maid of honor Anya Taylor-Joy. At the gala dinner that followed at the Getty Mansion, Pelosi stayed past midnight, mixing with hundreds of Ivy and Tobias's young friends and relatives. It was all so inclusive. You could let your freak flag fly, said one of them. Ivy's relatives, who had flown up from Los Angeles, have certainly done their part to support inclusivity. Siblings August Getty and Natalia Nats Getty and Nats' spouse, Gigi Gorgeous, have become high-profile advocates for gay and transgender rights. But it was August and Nat's mother, Ariadne, a daughter of Paul Jr., who led the way. While she had rejoiced in her children's identities when they each came out to her as gay, she grew fearful as she saw an increase in discrimination and violence against LGBTQ plus people after Donald Trump got elected. Previously a shy philanthropist, Ariadne journeyed to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland in January 2018, accompanied by August, Nats, and Gigi, to announce her response, a $15 million gift to GLAAD, the LGBTQ plus media monitoring organization. In her children's early years, Ariadne felt a need to protect them from the weight that came with the Getty name. Brought up using their father's surname, Williams, they were not told anything about their mother's family. Even on school field trips to the J. Paul Getty Museum, they were unaware they had any connection to it. It was only around 2000 when the family located for a decade to England, where August and Nats would be attending schools with their cousins, that their mother told them about their Getty blood. As young adults, both siblings chose to use the Getty surname, and each launched a fashion line. In 2021, Nats adopted the male pronoun when he announced his gender transition. The extravagant custom creations of August Getty Atelier have been worn by the likes of Lady Gaga, Katy Perry, Miley Cyrus, and others. I just want to make the world a shinier place, one sequin at a time, he says. With his online company, Strike Oil, Nats produces hoodies, trucker hats, and other staples of streetwear, to which he gives an arty luxe spin. In choosing the name, Nats paid homage to his great-grandfather, who stated that the key to success was rise early, work hard, and strike oil. It's one of my favorite rules to live by. I have it tattooed on my right ankle, Nats says. Gigi, growing up as Gregory Lazzarato near Toronto, found her path forward in high school when she discovered the power of cosmetics, which led her to make video makeup tutorials and post them on YouTube. When she moved to L.A. in 2014, she was already a tall, striking blonde, but still in the transition process, which involved years of hormone treatments and surgeries, all of which she documented on social media. In the process, she gained some 8 million followers across YouTube and other platforms, and a reputation as a trans role model. Despite wealth and privilege, Nats had struggled. I never realized how ill I truly was, he reflected in 2020. Between drugs, eating disorders, and mental health issues, I honestly felt I was knocking on death's door. I returned to a life of drugs, darkness, and self-hate. When he met Gigi in Paris in 2016, where both were walking in one of August's fashion shows, he saw this amazing bright light. 2 years later, Nats proposed, once again in France. As their helicopter landed at Chateau Vallecomte, which Nats had rented for the occasion, "Will You Marry Me?" appeared in large lights. Cue the fireworks. The following year, 200 formally clad guests attended their wedding in Montecito. The pandemic was a contemplative time for Nats. In January 2021, he posted a photo of himself bare-chested. "I am transgender, non-binary," he wrote. All his life, he explained, he had felt not in sync with the body I was born with. "I didn't fall in love with Nats because of his gender. I fell in love with the person he is," said Gigi shortly afterward, when at the same time she announced her new status as pansexual. Then Nats got back to business. With its new oil spill tea, Strike Oil continued to attract buzz. Machine Gun Kelly was spotted wearing one. "Pretty much since we came out the womb, we've been who we are," Nats summed up about his family, "and no one was going to tell us otherwise." This article was from Growing Up Getty, The Story of America's Most Unconventional Dynasty, by James Reginato. Copyright 2022 by James Reginato. Reprinted by permission of Gallery Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Free Radicals by James Pogue. They're not MAGA, they're not QAnon. In the crucible of 2022 conservatism, the power brokers are influenced by an intellectual new right that envisions itself as the most dangerous sort of cool. Vanity Fair reports from their party at the end of the world. Opening illustration of Toppling Columns in Red, White, and Blue by Brian Stauffer. It was Halloween in Orlando, and we had piled into a car to make a short trip from the Hilton to an after-party down the road to wind up the first night of the latest edition of a gathering called the National Conservatism Conference. For at least many of the young people, the actual business of conference going seemed to be beside the point, a gesture at how we used to conduct politics back before life in America spun out of control. There were jokes, or maybe they were serious questions, about whether one of the guys tagging along with us was a Fed. I surreptitiously made a few searches of the name he'd given me, and was surprised when I couldn't find a single plausible hit, though that could have been because he was a hyper-secret crypto type. There were some of those floating around. Not that anyone cared. These were people who were used to guarding their words. "Don't F me here," a dark-haired woman named Amanda Milius said to me, as she somewhat imperiously dealt with a guy at the door who was skeptical about letting a party in, a reporter, rather, into the party. "And say we're all in here sacrificing kids to Moloch. We're just the last normal people hanging out at the end of the world." I had met Milius outside the Hilton when I asked for a cigarette, and she began to chaperone me around, telling people who eyed my press pass that I was there to profile her as an up-and-coming female director, who, she said, had attracted more Amazon streams than any woman ever with her first documentary, a counter-narrative about Russiagate. "Annie Leibovitz is still scheduling the photo shoot," she kept saying. In this world, almost every word is layered in so much irony that you can never be sure what to take seriously or not. Perhaps a semi-conscious defense mechanism for people convinced that almost everyone is out to get them. "Oh, F," she said as we walked into a small ballroom where the party was already underway. The room was pitifully quiet, lit in strip club red, and the sparse crowd was almost entirely male, with a cash bar off in the corner that seemed unable to produce drinks fast enough to buoy the mood. "We have a thing we say," she said. "This is what the people at the Washington Post think we're doing." "Well, this is exactly what the people at the Washington Post think we're doing." A portly guy running for Congress in Georgia made his way to the front of the room to give a speech heavy on MAGA buzzwords and florid expressions of fealty to Donald Trump. "This is sad," Milia said. No one cheered or even seemed interested. But this was not Trump world, even if many of the people in the room saw Trump as a useful tool. And these parties aren't always so lame. NatCon, as this conference is known, has grown into a big tent gathering for a whole range of people who want to push the American right in a more economically populist, culturally conservative, assertively nationalist direction. It draws everyone from Israel hawks to fusty paleocon professors to mainstream figures like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. But most of the media attention that the conference attracts focuses on a cohort of rosy young blazer-wearing activists and writers, a crop of people representing the American right's radical young intellectuals, as a headline in the New Republic would soon put it, or conservatism's terrifying future, as David Brooks called them in The Atlantic. But the people these pieces describe, who made up most of the partygoers around me, were only the most buttoned-up seam of a much larger and stranger political ferment, burbling up mainly within America's young and well-educated elite, part of an intramedia class info war. The podcasters, bro-ish anonymous Twitter posters, online philosophers, artists, and amorphous scenesters in this world are variously known as dissidents, neo-reactionaries, post-leftist, or the heterodox fringe. Though they're often all grouped for convenience under the heading of America's New Right, they have a wildly diverse set of political backgrounds, with influences ranging from 17th century Jacobite royalist to Marxist cultural critics to so-called reactionary feminist to the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, whom they sometimes refer to with semi-ironic affection as Uncle Ted, which is to say that this new right is not a part of the conservative movement as most people in America would understand it. It's better described as a tangled set of frameworks for critiquing the systems of power and propaganda that most people reading this probably think of as the way the world is. And one point shapes all of it. It is a project to overthrow the thrust of progress, at least such as liberals understand the word. These worldviews, run counter to the American narrative of the last century, that economic growth and technological innovation are inevitably leading us toward a better future. It's a position that has become quietly edgy and cool in new tech outposts like Miami and Austin, and in downtown Manhattan, where new rightish politics are in, and signifiers like a demure cross necklace have become markers of a transgressive chic. No one is leading this movement, but it does have key figures. One is Peter Thiel, the billionaire who helped funded NatCon and who had just given the conference's opening address. Thiel has also funded things like the edgelordy and post-left-inflected New People's Cinema Film Festival, which ended its week-long run of parties and screenings in Manhattan just a few days before NatCon began. He's long been a big donor to Republican political candidates, but in recent years, Thiel has grown increasingly involved in the politics of this younger and weirder world, becoming something like a nefarious godfather or a genial rich uncle, depending on your perspective. Podcasters and art world figures now joke about their hope to get so-called Thiel bucks. His most significant recent outlays have been to two young Senate candidates who are deeply enmeshed in this scene and influenced by its intellectual currents. Hillbilly Elegy author J.D. Vance, who was, before this article went to press, running for the Republican nomination in Ohio, and Blake Masters in Arizona. Thiel has given more than $10 million to super PACs supporting the men's candidacies, and both are personally close to him. Vance is a former employee of Thiel's Mithril Capital, and Masters, until recently the COO of Thiel's so-called family office, also ran the Thiel Foundation, which has become increasingly intertwined with this new right ecosystem. These three, Thiel, Vance, Masters, are all friends with Curtis Yarvin, a 48-year-old ex-programmer and blogger who has done more than anyone to articulate the world historical critique and popularize the key terms of the new right. You'll often hear people in this world, again under many layers of irony, call him things like Lord Yarvin or Our Prophet. I was looking around the party for Vance, who hadn't arrived yet, when Milius nudged me and pointed to a table off to our left. Why is it that whenever I see Curtis, he's surrounded by a big table of incels? She asked with apparent fondness. I spotted Yarvin, a slight, bespectacled man with long dark hair, drinking a glass of wine with a crowd that included Josh Hammer, the national conservatism-minded young opinion editor of Newsweek, and Michael Anton, a Machiavelli scholar and former spokesman for Trump's National Security Council, and a prominent public intellectualizer of the Trump movement. Other luminaries afoot for the conference included dignity author Chris Arnotti, who seemed slightly unsure about the whole NatCon thing, and Sarab Armari, the former opinion editor of the New York Post, now a co-founder and editor at the new magazine Compact, whose vision is, according to its mission statement, shaped by our desire for a strong social democratic state that defends community, local and national, familial and religious, against a libertine left and a libertarian right. It is a very of-the-moment project. Political reporters, at least the ones who have bothered to write about Yarvin, have often dismissed him as a kook, with a readership made up mostly of lonely internet weirdos, fascists, or both. But to ignore him is to underestimate how Yarvin's ideas, or at least ideas in conversation with his, have become foundational to a whole political and cultural scene that goes much deeper than anything you'd learn from the panels and speeches at an event like NatCon, or how those ideas are going to shape the future of the American right, whether or not Vance and Masters win their Senate primaries. I introduced myself, and soon Milius and I were outside smoking as Yarvin and I chatted about whether he'd be willing to talk to me on the record. People often struggle with what to make of Thiel's involvement in this ecosystem. Last year, the journalist Max Chafkin published a biography of Thiel, titled The Contrarian, in which he described Yarvin as the House political philosopher for a network often called the Thielverse. The book focuses heavily on Thiel's political maneuverings, describing how he evolved from being a hyper-libertarian to someone who now makes common cause with nationalist and populist. And it explains how Thiel helped both Cruz and Josh Hawley on their paths to the Senate. The Contrarian ends with a dark picture of the billionaire trying to extend his political reach ever more overtly by funding and shepherding the campaigns of Masters and Vance. Masters and Vance are different from Hawley and Cruz, Chafkin writes. The former two are extensions of Thiel. This is only partly true. It would be just as accurate to say that Thiel has been influenced by the intellectual currents and political critiques of the new right that he's now helping to support. Many of these people are friendly with Thiel, or admire him, but are by no means beholden to him. And many of them hold views that would seem to make Thiel, a tech oligarch currently worth around $8 billion, who recently resigned from the Meta, nay, Facebook, board of directors, their natural enemy. This new right is heavily populated by people with graduate degrees, so there's a lot of debate about who is in it and whether or not it even exists. At one end are the NatCons, post-liberals and traditionalist figures like Benedict Option author Rod Dreher, who envision a conservatism reinvigorated by an embrace of localist values, religious identity, and an active role for the state in promoting everything from marriage to environmental conservation. But there's also a highly online set of Substack writers, podcasters, and anonymous Twitter posters, our true intellectual elite, as one podcaster describes them. This group encompasses everyone from rich crypto bros and tech executives to back to the landers to disaffected members of the American intellectual class, like Up in the Air author Walter Kern, whose fulminations against groupthink and techno-authoritarianism have made him an unlikely champion to the dissident right and heterodox fringe. But they share a basic worldview that individualistic liberal ideology, increasingly bureaucratic governments, and big tech are all combining into a world that is at once tyrannical, chaotic, and devoid of the systems of value and morality that give human life richness and meaning. As Blake Masters recently put it, a dystopian hell world. Kern didn't want to put a label on this movement, describing it as a fractious family of dissenters, when I called him at his home in Montana. A somewhat new, loose coalition of people whose major concern is that we not end up in a top-down controlled state. He told me he didn't consider himself right-wing and found some of the anti-democratic ideas he heard expressed in this sphere to be personally chilling. But he described it as a zone of experimentation and free expression of a kind that was now closed off in America's liberal mainstream. They seem to want a war, he said. The last thing I want is some kind of definitive ideological war, which leaves out the heterodox, complicated, and almost naively open spirit of American politics. And the ferment is starting to get noticed. I think that's a really good sign, one of the hosts of the dissident right podcast, The Fed Post, said recently, discussing how Tucker Carlson had just quoted a tweet from one of their guests. This is a kind of burgeoning sect of thought, he went on, and it's causing people who are in possessions and in positions of larger influence and relative power to actually have to start looking into it. Vance sits somewhere in between these two tendencies. At 37, he's a venture capitalist who is young enough to be exposed to the dissident online currents. But he's also shaped by the most deeply traditionalist thinking of the American right. He is friends with Yarvin, whom he openly cites as a political influence, and with Dreher, who was there when Vance was baptized into the Catholic Church in 2019. I'd been writing about militias and right-wing stirrings in the rural West for years, but I didn't really understand how this alchemy worked until I first met him last July. I'd gone back to Ohio to see my uncle, who was dying of cancer. Vance and I both grew up around Cincinnati, immersed in a culture of white rural migrants who had come from coal fields and farm towns to look for work in the cities of the Midwest. We had met as a kind of experiment. I was going to be in town anyway, and because my uncle was sick, I was thinking a lot about the place and what it meant to me. On a whim, I asked an editor at a conservative magazine if I could write something from the perspective of a skeptical leftist. Vance suggested that we meet at a diner where my dad had often taken me as a kid. He was barely registering in the polls at the time. Vance believes that a well-educated and culturally liberal American elite has greatly benefited from globalization, the financialization of our economy, and the growing power of big tech. This has led an Ivy League intellectual and management class, a quasi-aristocracy he calls the regime, to adopt a set of economic and cultural interests that directly oppose those of people in places like Middletown, Ohio, where he grew up. In the Vancean view, this class has no stake in what people on the new right often call the real economy, the farm and factory jobs that once sustained middle-class life in middle America. This is a fundamental difference between new right figures like Vance and the Reaganite right-wingers of their parents' generation. To Vance, and he said this, culture war is class warfare. Vance recently told an interviewer, "I gotta be honest with you, I don't really care what happens to Ukraine." A flick at the fact that he thinks the American-led global order is as much about enriching defense contractors and think tank types as it is about defending America's interest. "I do care about the fact that in my community right now, the leading cause of death among 18 to 45-year-olds is Mexican fentanyl." His criticism of big tech as enemies of Western civilization often gets lost in the run of Republican outrage over Trump being kicked off Twitter and Facebook, though they go much deeper than this. Vance believes that the regime has sold an elusive story that consumer gadgets and social media are constantly making our lives better, even as wages stagnate and technology feeds an epidemic of depression. I wrote a piece that came across as critical of him. It expressed my deep hopelessness about the future of America. I figured he'd want nothing more to do with me. But the morning it was published, he sent me a short, heartfelt email. He said that he'd been a bit pained to read in the piece that my parents disliked him, but said he'd like to talk more. "I don't see you as a member of the elite, because I see you as independent of their ideological strictures and incentives, he wrote. But maybe I'm just saying that because I like you. Despair, he signed off, serves the regime. Part of why people have trouble describing this new right is because it's a bunch of people who believe that the system that organizes our society and government, which most of us think of as normal, is actually bizarre and insane, which naturally makes them look bizarre and insane to people who think this system is normal. You'll hear these people talk about our globalized consumerist society as clown world. You'll often hear the worldview expressed by our media and intellectual class described as the Matrix or the Ministry of Truth. As Thiel described it in his opening keynote speech to NatCon, it can be confusing to turn on something like the influential underground podcast Good Old Boys and hear a figure like Anton talk to two autodidact Southern gamers about the makeup of the regime. If only because most people reading this probably don't think of America as the kind of place that has a regime at all. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.